Yeah, so I will talk about this neutral theory of biodiversity, and I should first maybe tell you how I came to write about this, because this is not the field I'm working on. I mean, I've done some very much niche-based speciation models, typical models of sympatric speciation. I have not worked at all on this neutral theory, but I somehow came to write a review about it. The way this happened is that I was asked by the editor of BioEssays to write a comment on a paper that had come out that he found interesting, and then I agreed to do this, and it kind of extended in this little review about the role of different speciation models in neutral theory. This paper has come out already last year in BioEssays. How does that work? Okay. And I thought it might be a good idea to promote it a little bit here. So I will have to give a little introduction into this neutral theory for those of you who are not well acquainted with it. And then I'll talk a little bit about non-genetic speciation models, that's what is usually done in neutral theory, and then about this, mainly about this one paper I was actually asked to write about, which is an explicit genetic speciation model, and then show some like pretty tentative conclusions, and all of this within 12 minutes or so. So as you probably know, the neutral theory of biodiversity kind of rose to prominence with the publication of this book by Steve Hubble in 2001, which is called The Unified Neutral Theory of Biodiversity and Biogeography. And it's an ecological theory which is quite radical in a way, because it assumes that all species within a trophic level are ecologically equivalent. So they're basically doing the same things. There is no competition except for a place in the community. There's nothing just as limiting similarity, and there are no niches. It's maybe worth pointing out that this theory basically deals with organisms within a trophic level, and the prime examples are trees in tropical forests, so it doesn't really say anything about trophic interactions. And the key, the key processes that are driving diversity, or the dynamics of diversity in this model, are what is called ecological drift, which is just random birth and death of individuals, which leads to random fluctuations in population sizes of species. And dispersal over space and speciation is what ultimately creates diversity. So you can already guess from that it's in a way pretty similar to the neutral theory of molecular evolution. Indeed, in many instances, it's quite the same. The math is the same. Instead of talking about alleles, you're talking about species now. But there's one difference to the neutral theory of genetics. That already the very basic model is a spatially structured model. The way it works, that is, there are two communities. One is called the local community. The other is called the meta community. You can also think of this as a continent island model. So the meta community is like a continent, which is very big. The local community is something smaller, which is being colonized from this continent. And in both of these communities, individuals die and get born. But then effectively only happens in the meta community, because it can be neglected in the local community. And the species found in the local community are sampled from those that immigrate from the meta community into the local community. Yeah, so what can we then use this theory for? So, of course, as there are no niches and no species differences in this theory, the theory cannot say anything about ecological diversification, for example, but it can say something about statistical patterns of species abundances. And like the most prominent pattern that people have analyzed is the so-called species abundance distribution. That is, so how many species have a certain density, how many species have a single individual, two, and so on. And this is an old question, and there are like several models out. So typical models are what is called the log series model, where most of the species are very rare. Another classical model is a log normal distribution, yeah, where most of the species have an intermediate density, and then what comes out of the neutral theory actually is a distribution called the zero-sum multinomial distribution, which has more rare species in the log normal distribution. And just to be very quick, because it's not really the main topic of the talk, it turns out that the log series distribution is the one that applies to this meta community, so that comes out of birth, death, and speciation events. And the zero-sum multinomial is one can derive for the local communities. And then there are other things that neutral theory can talk about, for example, species area relationships, as we will hear about in the next talk, beta diversity, basically spatial turnover in species, or something about phylogenies, as we've heard in the previous talk. Okay, so what this theory is good for or not good for, one could probably argue about this for evenings or whole workshops or whatever. So I cannot really say much about that. I think it's, from my point of view, it might be maybe comparatively uncontroversial that it is a useful null model. And people who are working on this theory, they emphasize that in contrast to much other ecological theory, it like gives its proper place to issues of stochasticity and dispersal limitation, and can also tell something about the properties of samples one takes from communities. I cannot talk about that. If you want to know more about it, you can read this paper by David Alonso et al., who is kind of a defense of this theory. And yeah, maybe just if you want my very personal opinion, so I thought like reading Hubble's book was very rewarding, and one gets the feeling that like doing all these exercises, calculating what happens if nothing happens except these very basic processes is definitely something that's interesting to know. On the other hand, maybe there's also more to ecology than just these species abundance distributions, if I can put it that way. Anyway, so what I'm really going to talk about is how speciation is handled in this neutral theory. And the way that speciation is handled in about, 95% of neutral models is what's called point mutation speciation. That is, speciation is the same as a mutation. Individual gets born, and with a certain small probability, it's the founding member of a new species. Of course, like now that we have, in this workshop, we are making all these complicated theories about how speciation could work, and that it's sometimes more or less difficult. And so this is clearly a vast simplification. The good thing is that by treating speciation like mutation, we can actually treat the species like a lesion. We can directly import results from population genetics and directly apply them to ecology. But, as I said, it's an obviously unrealistic assumption in a way, it would seem. So, of course, people have noticed that and then have tried other neutral models with other modes of speciation, like the opposite to the point mutation would be what's called random fission speciation, where the new species is just a random part of the original species. Or you could do something in between, where like peripheral isolated speciation, where new species have a certain size, but not necessarily one. But an interesting thing then happens, that is, if you try to use these models and fit them to these species abundance distributions, it turns out that the point mutation model actually works best. So, and this is, of course, like probably one of the main reasons why neutral theory has become kind of famous, because one of its early successes was to produce this distribution that quite nicely fits empirical species abundance distribution. And these early models all use the point mutation assumption. And it's maybe worth thinking for a moment about to what degree we believe in this theory, and if we believe to it in some degree, whether this actually tells us something about the actual size of new species. Because if this is true, then this means that most species start out with small population sizes, and that is ultimately an empirical question, maybe an interesting one. So in this regard, the point mutation model fares quite well, but it also has its problems. And the problems is if you start thinking about speciation rates and timescales and so on, because with point mutation speciation, as we also know from population genetics, like these new species arise, a single individual, most of them will die out immediately, or almost immediately. Nobody will ever see them, nobody will ever give them a scientific name. The mean lifetime of species will be very short. To make up for this, speciation rate needs to be really high, and if you try to estimate these numbers, they are completely unrealistic. So there is a problem here. And just one possible solution to this is actually this protracted speciation model that Rampal has been talking about quite a lot in the previous talk. I didn't know he would be talking about it. But it's for a different purpose here. So you already know it. It basically just assumes that like incipient species arise as single individuals, but they are only kind of graduate to full species status after a certain time, and of course only those that actually survive this time. And the predictions from this model are more or less the same than those of the point mutation model. It only differs in the predicted density of the very, very rare species, because it predicts that there are less of those rare species. This is actually not something that can be tested empirically, because these rare species are so rare that you cannot hope to ever find them anyway. But this protected speciation model provides an argument which solves these problems about species lifetimes, high extinction rates, and so on, because most of these lineages that go extinct now are actually never been species. Okay, so all of these models so far have been, of course, very phenomenological, and that's probably what most of the time we want to do in a theory like this, where you're also just interested in a statistical outcome. Nevertheless, like in reality, in sexual species, speciation is, of course, a process that involves genetics, reproductive isolation, things like that. So can we also use genetic speciation models to plug them into this theory and produce this kind of patterns? And as we've heard this morning, so roughly we can divide speciation models into those ecological speciation models, non-ecological speciation models. Kind of obviously for a neutral theory, only the non-ecological ones will do, because we cannot assume niches. And I will now basically just quickly talk about one model. That's the one which kind of prompted this whole review that I wrote. It's come out in Nature in 2009, so which is a genetically explicit speciation model, which has now then been used to analyze these predicted patterns of biodiversity. And actually it's in a way quite similar to the model that Rupert has talked about. So it's a spatially explicit model. Individuals are living on a grid. They are characterized by a string, which you could think of as their genome. And individuals mate and reproduce with each other, but they only mate with individuals that are within a certain spatial neighborhood and which are genetically similar. And basically this fact creates the sexual selection that also Rupert has talked about and leads to the, and together with mutation, that leads to the spatial clustering of species, just as we've heard before. And this works best if, I have to hurry up now, as you see, this works best if both the spatial distance and the genetic distance for mating is small. And as far as a speciation model goes, this is not really entirely new. Like Sergei Gavrilets has done similar things before. What these guys then did was to apply this model and look at these patterns of species, how many we get at a certain snapshot in time, and then found that basically the patterns one gets out of them in terms of, for example, species abundance distributions or species area relationships kind of look those that one sees in nature. Even though with a qualification that these are not really fits to the model, you kind of have to where you see that there are different axes for the data points and for the predictions. That's because in this explicit model, you cannot simulate very large populations, so you kind of have to blow up your results and just see if you get a qualitative fit then. Okay, I'm about to finish anyway. So there are like one or two more similar models. There's a pretty interesting approach by Sergey Gavrilets, I think, to also model like genetic models and then use them to infer the patterns of diversity that came out of them. And there's another one by Carlos Melian, which has recently been published. I cannot tell a lot about them. And then, as conclusions, outlook, summary, whatever, I just to repeat that it appears that what's important for these kind of statistical patterns that neutral theory is studying, usually the size of incipient species is very important. And it seems that the best fits are gained by those models that have small incipient species. And we can actually use genetic models to also produce this kind of patterns. And it's kind of an outlook, of course, it would at least be possible to try to do the same kind of things also with models that include mechanisms of ecological speciation and adaptive radiation that would then enable some kind of comparisons and maybe tell us a little bit more. Okay.
One question.
So I'm interested in your comment that the neutral theory makes a good null hypothesis. My read of Hubble is that he's presenting a theory, and theories should be tested against nulls. And so does the neutral theory itself actually represent a very good null hypothesis in your view?
Well, at least it's a null model in the sense that it tells us what happens if almost nothing happens. It's a null hypothesis.
I'm not sure I really get what.
Well, so I guess what I'm saying is I think a theory generally has, it may have many assumptions or very few assumptions.
Yeah,
so I would agree that the neutral theory is attempting to make very few assumptions.
Yeah.
But it makes some very, very strong assumptions that are quite different. So to me, philosophically, a theory does not provide a null for another theory. Now you can compete them, you can study them. So in other words, if the neutral theory had come along first, could then your Yehir have come up with his continuous, and we say that's the appropriate null for the neutral theory. So I'm just intrigued with this idea of using...
Let's continue that discussion later.
So maybe very quickly, maybe this goes back to the whole philosophical discussion about null hypothesis anyway. So how can one hypothesis pretend to be the null hypothesis? Maybe it's better to do something like literature or whatever, just to compare things at kind of an equal footing. But that's not just a problem of this kind of model.